KZSU-FM Stamford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stamford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor David Perlmutter of the University of Iowa, who is going to be on the show primarily focusing on his book written a few years ago called Blog Wars, but also towards the end and catering directly towards the tenure-track professor listenership of Hearsay Culture. I'm going to ask him a few questions towards the end regarding his more recent book, Promotion and Tenure Confidential, which is aimed at non-law schools, but certainly having read the book and being someone who is up for tenure right now. In fact, I need to get my tenure materials in at the end of this week. This is a particular timely topic for me right now. So partially self-serving, perhaps, but I think of interest to many of the listeners of the show. We'll ask a few questions there. However, the focus of our discussion is going to be on blogs and on citizen media. This is a topic that we've discussed on Hearsay Culture going back to its very beginnings when I had Professor Lessigon in one of the early shows to discuss his work in code and free culture, so much of which, of course, deals with what he coined as the rewrite culture. But even going forward from Lessig's work, we've had many other people on, from Jamie Boyle at Duke to Eric Davis to a variety of other people who have talked about this world of citizen media and of individuals commenting on the world around them through this structured medium that we call blogs. In Blog Wars, David's focus heavily is on the relationship between bloggers and traditional media, as well as the impact of blogging on a variety of topics regarding government operations and politics and social relationships and many other areas. The book having been written a few years ago, of course, we have an increasing explosion in citizen media, and not just in the now we can say the traditional blog format, but in even newer formats involving social media and tweets and other ways that people use technology to communicate their ideas and their thoughts and ultimately their concerns and suggestions to others. Part of that discussion, of course, is something we'll be talking about, is the difference between blogs and social media from the standpoint of having, in one instance with a blog, having the world as your potential readership versus social media websites like Facebook, where you have what others have called the walled garden, where only certain people have access. And so we're going to spend some time talking about those issues as well, and ultimately have a pretty wide-ranging discussion before we turn towards the end, towards a couple of more specific and narrow questions regarding the tenure process. But David's work is work that I've been familiar with, and I'm excited to have him on the show, and I appreciate him taking his time today. Again, his very brief introduction before we get into the discussion. David is the director of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and a professor and Starch Faculty Fellow at the University of Iowa, and many listeners may know his work writing the PNT Confidential column for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's joining us via Skype from his home in Iowa. David, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
David, let's start off with a question I ask most of my guests. Perhaps you could talk about the genesis of your interest in technology and blogging and a bit more about your background and how you got to this point.
Well, when I talked to young scholars, probationary faculty, tenure-track faculty, I often say that a sad but true fact is that we don't tenure Renaissance people. We want you to specialize in some area, actually a sub-area within a sub-area, within an area, become the expert on that. That's really the push across all of academia. I don't think it's the best thing for the country and for learning in general, but it's simply a fact of life. Now, I've been very lucky that I've made some transitions in my interests and gotten away with it. and now that I'm actually tenured as a professor, I guess it's a little easier to get away with that. And I've first started out being fascinated by pictures, and I actually almost got my PhD in art history, but I ended up in communications because I was also interested in electronic media and the transmission of images. And I sort of called that visual communication, which is a subfield within our discipline, but I always thought about the politics of images, so I also said I was in political communication. I happened to marry my wife still today, very happily married to a young lady from Iowa. And so we would go to Iowa as much to visit relatives of hers during the summer. Now, of course, I'm in Iowa. And I always found a reason to be in Iowa the summer before the caucuses and the presidential campaign and the presidential election year. I found very quickly that that was the sort of early warning radar about new trends in political campaigns and elections. And I became fascinated very early on the trial runs of new ideas and new technologies. I often point out that my friends who are political consultants, it's the toughest business in the world because your product is either 0% successful or 100% successful in an American-style democracy. You know, in most product lines, if you have, say, 40% market share, that's pretty good. But politics just means you're just a sad loser. So they're very interested in something new. At the same time, there's a lot of pressure to use something that they know has already worked. And resolving that tension is fascinating as a scientist trying to observe something in nature. I was very lucky that my first job for 10 years was at LSU in Baton Rouge. And it's a lot like, and I'm not comparing myself to Charles Darwin, but a lot of people point out that Darwin probably would have never discovered the evidence for evolution just in the green and pleasant backyard of England. He had to go to South America where there was jungles and lots of intense competition for niches in the environment and so on, and survival of the fittest. Louisiana is a wonderful state for hot, hot politics and real, real rough housing in elections. And boy, you really pick up on new trends there as well. So I got a sort of triangulation on new things happening in politics. And of course, I'm in my late 40s now, 47 years old, and I was born before the era of the internet. It's hard to even explain that to students now, that there was a time before the internet. There was even a time before texting, which is really remarkable. I just use, you know, I would get my pet dinosaur to carry a rock with an inscription to my friends.
Right.
That was Facebook back then. But so I very early on wanted to start tracking what was happening with this new thing called the internet and the World Wide Web. And in fact, a colleague of mine wrote, a colleague and I wrote and we published, I think, what was one of the very first papers on presidential websites for the 1996 election. And we observed at that time that most websites were really tack boards. I mean, they were very useful tack boards in that most people could not have gotten access to, say, full text of a campaign speech, a campaign's official policy paper, a transcript of a press conference. It would have been very hard before the era of the internet for any ordinary citizen or even reporters to get access to that without direct access to a campaign. So it was performed a very useful function, but there really wasn't any interactivity. It was more just, here's interesting stuff that you can download. So then, as technology progressed, I was very lucky to be there in Iowa in the summer of 2003. Howard Dean, a candidate with nothing, no major funding, no major endorsements, no major constituency, no name recognition, none of the things you're supposed to have when you're going to be elected president, comes along, and his staff comes up with this idea of the People's Campaign, and let's use this new thing called social online interactive media to reach people directly, and we don't need the big media bucks and the big media buys and the big endorsements and so on. So I just was able very early on to sort of track the evolution of these new platforms, venues, and technologies in politics.
The focus of your book and the focus of your work is this intersection of blogs and generally government operations. But you title your book "Blog Wars," and I'm curious to know why the title. What are you referring to in the context of blog wars?
Well, conflict was an early and, you might argue, necessary component and philosophy of social media. Social media did not begin with friends chatting. It began with people arguing, or rather a lot of venues which were supposed to be sort of kindly or gentlemanly intercessions of ideas became quickly places where people duked it out rhetorically. If you go back even before the commercial internet, the rise of bulletin boards, remember flaming?
Yeah, sure.
That term is not used that much anymore. Flames and flame wars, and you'd get together with 60 other Bruce Springsteen fans on the bulletin board service, and you know, within 6 months, it would devolve into people threatening each other to blow up each other's homes, you know, if you disagreed on which was Bruce Springsteen's best album.
Mm-hmm.
And so there seemed to be sort of a gravitational pull towards conflict. Now, we know from a lot of research in our field, psychology, sociology, and others, there really is an allowance and a propensity of people through the anonymity or the pseudonymity of computer interface or electronic interface to say and express a lot of things they wouldn't do face-to-face. There really is a keyboard effect. If you think, I have written a lot of newspaper op-eds over the years, and about 200 of them, and now I write a monthly column. And I used to keep a collection, I don't do anymore, it was no longer fun, of when people would write me hot, angry emails reacting to something in a column. And I would unless they actually threatened my life, I would always write back. And I was interested in how many times somebody would send me an email where the subject line was, "You bleeping idiot," and then the rest of it was in the same vein. And then I would write back and I'd say, "Dear sir, you know, I'm so sorry that you took what I wrote in that column to so negatively, you know, let me try to explain what I was saying." I always come back really politely and gently, and I found about 70-80% of the time people would reply really toned down. So it was clear that they just expressed themselves hot anger first thing, you know, no interlocutor between the brain and the keyboard, which I think is increasingly a challenge of humanity and not just individuals. So blogging, of course, unleashed that potential on us, on the whole world, with really very few stopgaps and a lot of people encouraging each other, especially the partisanship, to get hotter and angrier and angrier and angrier.
So if we're referring to blogging in the context of war, I'm curious, you know, as we begin our discussion, I should be clear, and I think this is going to sound like a pedantic question, but I think it's important. I mean, how do you define a blog? And that sounds like an academic question, but I think it's important because we have a somewhat blurred definition of what we think might be a blog these days. What is your definition of a blog?
Well, the evolution of the definition is fascinating. The first blogs, the first websites that describe themselves as web blogs didn't come till the late 90s. They weren't prevalent until the early zeros. Typically, they were what might be called personal journals or diaries, just lists of thoughts on a sort of rotating barrel sheet of the latest is on top of the page, short, personalized, using first-person language, often unedited to the standards of, say, print production or broadcast production for blogs, a certain rawness about them. And really, the personal website of the 1990s evolved today into social media. Very few people talk about their personal website anymore as they talk about their something connected to something else. Mm-hmm. And so what's Tumblr today, what's Twitter today, what's Facebooking today are sort of, necessary and also inevitable variations on the theme of essentially the personal diary. And I always, as a sort of joke, I tell especially younger and older audiences about how I grew up at a time where you only published your personal thoughts in your personal diary posthumously. That the idea that you would just put them up there for everybody to read real time was, well, would be considered strange. Mm-hmm. If you imagine somebody in the 50s posting on the side of his house his thoughts.
Right.
or what he ate for lunch, you know. So that's the other part that fascinates me, is the sort of cognitive shift that's occurred. Our students today at Elon and Stanford and Iowa are the first generation. I think this class, the class of 2000, is coming in 2011, is really the first class that you can definitely say their entire tween and teen years, they grew up immersed in social media. Mm-hmm. Because social media really did not rise to real popularity until 2003, 2004. Facebook, Twitter, later. So now we're getting the people who were, well, they were, you know, 12 or something at the time. And that's very significant. And I talked to a lot of them in terms of our students. I talked to a lot of them in terms of our young alumni. They are changing the world, and they really think differently than we did because of this great mechanism that sort of trained them on how to express information and how to absorb information.
We're chatting with Professor David Perlmutter of University of Iowa, author of the book Blog Wars, as well as Promotion and Tenure Confidential on Hearsay Culture in KZSU-FM Stanford. You know, with regard to these blogs, and I mentioned social media up front, and I think before we get into some of the discussion about the impact of blogs on things like politics and policymaking, this contrast between social media and blogs I think is fascinating. And I mentioned in my introduction that we can view social media as the proverbial walled garden, right? You pick your friends, you allow access, you deny access to others, whereas the blog, at least as it was originally conceived, was truly, as you describe, writing something on the side of a wall for the public to see.
That's a really important transition. The very early days of the web, which I still remember, the promise of the web was a global village, that is, like everybody in the whole globe would be connected to each other. In fact, you have a lot of early quotes from the people who designed the web about how, you know, everybody will be together. Now, we've sort of learned in this next phase that most people don't want that. I don't want to be together with everybody. I only want to be together with the people that I allow through my filtering system to be my, quote, friends, unquote. Now, again, because I'm of a previous generation, I believe I have 264 Facebook friends, which in high school terms makes me a sad loner that they take to the school counselor to talk to. The students that I talk to, I just spoke to a student group about, I give talks on social media and branding yourself, how they try to be careful to create a profile on social media that employers will find attractive and not disincentives of pleasant pictures of them, you know, getting drunk or things like that, or saying negative comments. But I'm just fascinated. You know, I'll ask, how many friends do you have on Facebook? About 6,000, you know, 7,000. So even then, their filtering out is not as tight as what I would define as friend. And even then, you know, you can go even further. I mean, how many people only Facebook their true friends in the 1950s sense of a friend, you know, somebody who would, like, you would call in the middle of the night if you had an emergency, you know? Mm-hmm. So that transition from the open web and the open world of big everybody getting together in one big block party to the sort of circumscribed world of just my friends, that was a huge transition.
And that transition, I think, is one that we want to think about a bit more, and not in a normative sense of good or bad, but what the impact has been. Because, you know, certainly there's been quite a bit of writing talking about the echo chamber effect, not just obviously with Facebook, but again with blogs, that people tend to read people they agree with. Do you think, in terms of what you've written about blogs having this ability that we'll talk about later to reinvigorate politics, do you think that blogs and that analog social media can have that impact, given how we have built the walls that weren't there initially?
Well, we're actually holding next month here in Iowa a forum on politics and civil discourse, and I'm going to be doing a panel on social media, politics, blogging. There's two things I always want to remind people of. First, I'm not completely convinced that we suddenly have this incredibly hostile culture, whereas before people got along amicably. I mean, I don't necessarily think that the partisanship divide or the hostility level of political culture is greater today than, say, 1968 or 1952 or 1918 or 1865. Americans have always been pretty bitter in arguing about politics, depending on what were the great issues of the day. And there were issues of the day: civil rights movement, Vietnam, slavery, World War I, which did divide the nation, and people were very angry. I also remind people that when the Constitution was written and the word press was used, they were describing, well, blogs. They weren't describing the New York Times as much as when they described arms, they weren't describing thermonuclear weapons. Newspapers of the constitutional era, up really through the 1830s, were small circulation, not advertiser-supported. They were aligned with political parties. So they tended to only speak the voice of that particular political wing or faction. They weren't marketplaces of ideas in their pages. Now, you could go to a town and there'd be 50 newspapers you could pick, and certainly you could get a marketplace of ideas if you subscribed or bought all of them, but I tend to suspect that nobody actually did, unless they were sort of high-level political operatives trying to find out what the opposition was saying. So it wasn't exactly the case that in the golden moment of the founding of our country, people just got along and had these, you know, wonderful, thoughtful political debates and discussions without rancor or enmity. I think we've always had resonant in our political culture a feistiness, a rancorousness, and a bitterness. And the new kinds of media certainly unleash more people to say it louder in many different ways and more noticeably, but it's not that it wasn't there long ago as well.
And so, therefore, is it your view that as we stand here today in 2011, that blogs have merely been a medium by which more people can talk to each other, but really hasn't changed our behavior?
I think it absolutely has changed our behavior in several significant ways, and I'd be happy to go into that.
Yes.
I just think that it changed by tapping into pre-existing resident tendencies in human thinking and American political thinking. It didn't, like, invent these from scratch.
Right. And I guess that's my question. I mean, is this, I guess, and yeah, I would appreciate that answer. Is this just a matter of scaling, and that we've now scaled our communications in a way that highlights these differences that always existed, or what do you see as the impact of blogs on how we interact?
Well, I want to be careful about the words I use, because scaling implies that you're taking something and sort of unhomunculusing it upwards and making it just much bigger, like you're taking a chicken and turning it into a Tyrannosaurus Rex or something,
right.
Something like that, reverse engineering a chicken. The fact is, political behavior is different in many significant ways today, and you can see that by the way that just to something simple as the formation of a social movement. Some of the most recent social movements, whether it's the Arab countries or, I think, today with the Tea Party, but also the new Occupy Wall Street movement, are significantly changed in the way that they form and that they take action and the way that they express themselves by the fact that they have instant connection through social media and instant interactivity through social media. I wrote a paper a number of years ago with a colleague of mine who was from Kyrgyzstan, the former Soviet Republic of Kyrgyzstan, and we wrote about a revolution they had a number of years ago in which opposition people in the country, opposition to the then government, had found that they weren't in a total controlled press state, but they had few venues to express dissent except through blogs and so other social media. And so, well, that's how they organized themselves. And one weekend they organized themselves to go march at the presidential palace, and the government fled and they took over and became the government. Now, as I understand it, a new group shows up every Sunday demanding to be the government. So I don't think it works over and over again instantly every time, like some sort of formula. But that kind of thing probably would have been much harder to do and done in a much different way, especially when we're talking about young people who are plugged into that. I mean, yes, revolutions tend to be, the foot soldiers of revolutions tend to be youth. That's always been true. I mean, I'm sure the Bastille was not stormed by 80-year-olds, mm-hmm. but the leaders often are older. If you look at the Arab Spring revolts, though, you just see a lot of people texting each other, a lot of people Twittering each other. There's no question that at the forefront, social media is going to be at the forefront of every revolution today.
We're chatting with Professor David Perlmutter of the University of Iowa on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can click on Donate to KZSU on our new redesigned website. Regardless, I do hope you continue to listen to the station as well as to Hearsay Culture. You know, given that, you know, then this has been a somewhat theoretical discussion, David, but we can make it more concrete by thinking about some of the issues that you have discussed in the book, and that tie into some discussions we've had on the show previously. Morley Winograd and Mike Hayes were on the show a few years ago discussing their book Millennial Makeover, and among many other points that they make with regard to technology and politics. They were of a firm view, and as far as I know, remain firmly in the camp that believes that this same generation that you refer to, who are now starting college, will be the generation that does in fact reinvigorate politics, and they almost have an inevitable quality to their analysis. Do you see that as well? Because you write extensively in Blog Wars, and that book is admittedly a couple of years old now. So I'm curious to get your perspective now, given the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street and these other social movements. Do you have that same optimism today, as you did in 2008, that blogs and blogging will have that reinvigoration? Because we see quite a bit of cynicism and distrust of government, and a lot of people who are deciding that everyone's the same and therefore I shouldn't be involved at all.
Well, there's no question, and you can see it, that the internet generation, the social media generation, have remade politics professionally and in application. That's simply because that's who is actually working in political campaigns. If you look at most political campaigns, there's a huge number of young staff. I remember years ago, 2008, seems like a long time ago, I visited one of my former students from LSU who was working for the McCain campaign doing YouTube videos for McCain. And I was in Washington, and I wanted to take him and his wife to dinner to catch up. And he said, well, come by, I'll give you a little tour of part of the headquarters. So I went down there, and I think it was about 7 o'clock. And it was 7 o'clock. For most people my age, it had been 12 hours of campaigning. I think a lot of them were home asleep or having dinner or something. And he was still there working, and it was just a lot of young people. And that's, politics is so hard work. Campaigns are such hard work that a lot of young people gravitate and run a lot of the lower and middle level functions of campaigns. You'd still tend to see older folks as the key decision makers and, of course, the candidates, but the under 30 crowd permeates Washington. Well, they didn't like abandon their social interactive culture when they became working for a campaign. They just took it with them. And so they promulgated all of that all over the mechanics of campaigning, and now it's just there. It's not considered to be anything unusual or different. I mean, there's still endless experimentation with how it can work, but you can see the professional culture of political consulting and political media have changed pretty radically just in maybe 7 or 8 years.
With regard to that generation, you mention and discuss in your book at length the Rathergate scenario, the revelation of faked memos that Dan Rather had reported as being authentic, and which led ultimately in large measure to his resignation from CBS. I'm curious, and for those that don't remember that story, perhaps you could tell it quickly, but specifically, the mainstream media's reaction to these bloggers outing the story was interesting. So perhaps you could talk about that, both the story and the mainstream media's reaction, and why that's significant as we think about blogs.
Right. There's also been a transition in the relationship and the attitudes between, quote, mainstream media, unquote, and, quote, independent blogging, unquote, that's
right.
Occurred, again, extremely rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it began, and the sort of stereotype was, okay, there was the big journalist, columnist, big media, and then over here were the feisty independents who had no media credentials, who weren't journalists, who weren't politicians, who weren't government officers or politicians or political workers or anything. And they had a rivalry where the millions of ants were trying to take down the elephants. And Rathergate, which happened in about 2004 and then continued for a while, was basically about a 60 Minutes 2 program where there was the claim that there were these memos that existed and they were put up on the screen of that essentially President George Bush at the time in the National Guard had essentially gone AWOL and joined the Guard to avoid going to Vietnam and didn't do his Texas Air National Guard service and so on. And it's a pretty complicated story that I'm reducing to some pretty thin sentences here. But then bloggers, individual bloggers and others started coming out with questions. Now, here's an important point. There's a term I used to use I still do, called discourse elite. The discourse elite are people who, in traditional media structures, were allowed to speak. If you did surveys of television, radio news, and content analyses, you found that, say, pre-1990, a vast majority of the people who are quoted in the mainstream media were professionals of the discourse. They were professors, they were politicians, they were journalists, they were people who had achieved some sort of credential and then probably worked for a number of years before they were quoted or got to say something in the world of media. But now you had millions of people who they had an internet connection. Now, that didn't mean that they were some 10-year-old kid in their basement with a hunk of cheese in their underwear. That meant they were also, say, ex-majors in the Texas National Guard who had a typewriter from back then and were able to type out a piece of paper and see, well, gee, you know, we never used that font, or our signature was always slightly different, or the dating system was slightly different. In other words, there are a lot of people who were authentically experts. This was a really important phase in the development of blogging. It wasn't just a bunch of idiots screaming at each other. There were a lot of people who would have never been quoted in mainstream media because they'd never achieved that discourse elite status, but they were actually experts in what the area, the narrow area that they had in their own experience or their own resume. So that started coming up, and all these questions about, well, the font size and the dating and everything, and so many questions were raised. It became clear that CBS News didn't do a very good job of reporting. They didn't check the story enough. They didn't put it through the right experts. And a lot of questions were raised still to this day about whether that stuff was just, you know, fabricated and CBS was fooled, or they just thought it was such a great story they ran with it before they should have checked it out further. And I'm not exactly sure that we can say definitely that Dan Rather fell because of blogs, but certainly blogs, independent bloggers, especially conservative independent bloggers, felt that way. It was sort of a rallying cry, like, wow, you know, hey, we just slayed Goliath, everybody. Let's go find some more Goliaths. And that there was a morale change of gigantic proportions there among the blogging community that said, like, you know, we're bigger than big media now. We can take them down. We don't have to be afraid of them or think that they control us anymore.
And is that belief still prevalent today? You know, you see again, and I do use these phrases, but you see, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN. I mean, you see all of the major news outlets, traditional news outlets in the United States, using blog-like structures. They allow comments. They have eye reporters and so forth. And you write about this as well. Are we still in that same, you know, David versus Goliath mentality among bloggers? Is there still that belief, do you think? And again, admittedly, it's only 3 years after the publication of your book. It's a few more after Rathergate. Do you still sense that among the blogger community there's that optimism and belief, or has anything changed along those lines?
Well, I think there's a persistent ethos in American culture to, you never want to admit to being part of the establishment. I've met only a few people in my whole life who have said, yes, I am the establishment. people like to be the brave rebel, you know. I know, I guess you go to a science fiction convention, there are a lot of people dressed as stormtroopers and Darth Vader, but in political life, everybody likes to run against Washington, even if they've been a congressman for 30 years. Mm-hmm. So there still is this rhetoric of the independent blogger versus big media, but as you say, and as I document in my book, which was published in 2008, so it had already happened then, essentially big media had decided to co-opt blogging of a kind. Basically, every reporter was asked to start a blog or start doing social media as part of their column or part of their reports. Now it's just embedded within journalism. It's nothing strange that somebody, a columnist, also does a blog, and a blog is a column. And what's the difference between a column and a blog now? Just link the words up, almost. So really, the entire political establishment has adopted social media as a matter of course, so that at least structurally, it's hard to say that, like, over here is mainstream media and over here are the independents. There are still many people who consider themselves independent political bloggers, and the rhetorical attack on big government, on big media, on big is still part of their discourse.
Towards the end of the book, you come up with several categories or perhaps archetypes of bloggers, qualities that bloggers bring to the table. And, of course, we don't have the time to go into all of them. But the one that I found most fascinating, and certainly a major reason why I read blogs, I do very, very, very sporadic blogging. My radio show and podcast takes pretty much all of the time that I would have towards that form of communication, but I certainly read quite a few blogs, and you talk about the blogger as a collector and collator, which is a fascinating and new role, really, I think, with the advent of the internet. I mean, you had bibliographies, right? We had things that and resources that aggregated links. We see that in legal education, and we saw that in throughout research in a variety of topics, and not just law. But here you have the blogger as the collector and collator, and I'm curious whether you view that as the most useful, and I mean that in a very practical sense, the most useful role of the blogger in 2011. If the media is blogging, quote unquote, if you have you know, investigative journalism happening across the board, is that the most useful, and I mean that societally, role of the blogger today?
Yes, and of course a number of those roles can cohabit in the same person, and the example I always like to use is a gentleman that I actually haven't read his blog in about 6 months, so I hope he's still out of the air, so to speak, but the gentleman that I've met through my blogging research named John Burgess, who's a former State Department officer, and apparently he got fascinated during his years in the Middle East serving the country in Saudi Arabia. So he has a blog, which I'm blanking on his name now. I haven't looked at it in a while, like Saudi X-Arabia or something like that. Somebody can look it up. But the point was that he scans the news and his contacts and foreign press and other blogs of news from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And so I know that it was called Crossroads Arabia, the blog's called Crossroads Arabia. I know that if for some reason I'm interested in what's going on in Saudi Arabia, or I hear a news item and I want to learn more about it, I can go to him. Because I think there's practically no journalist on the planet whose assignment is just to cover Saudi Arabia. I mean, I teach and I'm administrator for a school of journalism and mass communication. I am very worried about the decline of coverage in journalism. Journalism has been cutting its budgets. A lot of people talk about journalism as getting out of the journalism business. The most expensive thing to do in journalism is journalism, covering events. It's incredibly expensive. So you see more and more papers cutting the number of reporters, cutting investigative reporting, cutting foreign reporting. You now have, I say this with respect for people who try to do this, but you see about a network that says our Africa correspondent. Mm-hmm. What? Right. You say one human being is covering Africa? Imagine if the other way around, if somebody said our America correspondent.
Right.
He's covering news in America.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We'd say what? One person, Los Angeles and rural North Carolina, the same person is just covering local news in both those places? That doesn't work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these experts, these specialty bloggers, can know a lot more than any journalist. They can be people who've written 20 books on Bosnia. They can be greater experts than we have access to today in the world of journalism. And if you're interested in the particular topic, you discover them and you follow them, and they're incredibly useful. And the technology and their own passion unleashes that for you. So, great.
Before we turn to a few questions regarding tenure and promotion, a narrower topic, but I do want to get your perspectives. You mentioned it earlier. I mean, in terms of, I don't ask crystal ball questions. After Manuel Castells was on the show and pointed out his lack of interest in answering such questions, I think it makes sense. So I'm not going to ask you a crystal ball question, but I will ask you, as we stand here today, you mentioned the Arab Spring, you mentioned Occupy Wall Street, the Tea Party. What do you see today as the main challenge for blogging and bloggers in 2011 in terms of what the community, this broad, diverse community of bloggers can do to up their game, to impact events? What do you see as the biggest challenge?
Well, in my book, I talked about how nobody should believe that Barack Obama won the presidency in 2008 because he had a terrific MySpace page. That the Obama team, I called them Howard Dean 2.0, because they learned some of the lessons of what didn't work with the Howard Dean campaign. And I always say, by the way, that the Howard Dean campaign was a prototype, and you should always respect people who fly that first test engine. Nobody wants to fly the first time, the X-1.
Okay? Right.
We want to fly the X-900,
right,
which is a Boeing 747 or something like that.
Right.
So a lot of respect to people who try something for the very first time. In fact, it's fascinating to me how many successful technologies of today were yesterday's failed innovation. We just forget the previous one, that somebody tried 5 years ago or 10 years ago, and then now it's worked in a different, better connectivity or so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the Obama team was able to marry the old wine and the new wine, the best of old politics. They had fantastic get out of the boat. They had fantastic registration campaign. They understood television ads, and they understood all the new venues and platforms and formats. So I would say that as my two cents of advice to any social movement is, don't think you will be successful just by texting each other or just by showing up for one flash mob and then going home. And I'm interested to see now, that was just in today's paper, there was advice from the civil rights movement leaders of yesteryear to today's Occupy Wall Street group. And they were talking about the difference between a rally and an organization, between marching and campaigning. And that's a very important one. And I don't know whether groups that sort of flash into existence because a lot of people text each other and Tumblr each other and say, hey, let's get together and do this, aren't what the word flash used to mean, which is something momentary and then it's gone. And so it's up to those movements to try to figure out, how can we make this sustainable? How can we make it long term? How can we make, turn it into actual practical legislation? Personally, I think saying end capitalism, well, you know, for, I guess here's my politics. I think we enjoy many fruits of capitalism, and I don't think the American people want to get rid of capitalism, but if you have something specific about some tax or some bill that we need to pass to make things better for the economy and better for jobs, and that's a huge challenge.
We're chatting with Professor David Perlmutter of the University of Iowa on KZZFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. David, I'm going to abruptly shift gears in the remaining 5 or 6 minutes that we have and ask this one unrelated question. And again, for those of you that listen to the show, you may be a professor, you may be a tenure-track professor. If you're not, I ask your indulgence for a few minutes. And I'll ask you this question. David, you've written this book, Promotion and Tenure Confidence, which came out last year from Harvard University Press, and I read it, and it has a lot of good advice, and it's advice, by the way, that I think is applicable not just to people in the humanities on whom you focus, but also law professors. But I'll ask you this one question: what is the best piece of practical advice that you can give for a tenure-track candidate that is a piece of advice that's either counterintuitive or that you rarely hear given? What would you say to that candidate, be it me or anyone else?
Well, I've always been fascinated at how professors are one of the only professions where nobody reads, plans, or does research in the profession itself. You know, you meet salespeople who read books on selling all the time. You know, you meet people in any profession, and they learn about their own profession. But we professors, you know, I mean, how many professors out there have read a book on promotion and tenure? How many professors have read memoirs of university presidents talking about university systems? I'm not trying to sell my book, but I'm just saying that I found we don't tend to plan and to rehearse. Plan means to think about how you want your career to progress from the very first day of graduate school through the day you become a full professor. I think that you can plan ahead. You don't have to just face things as they come. Rehearse means the following. I spent a couple of years being a reserve police officer doing a book on police work, and I was fascinated when the cops gave seminars and workshops on crime prevention, they always pointed out to people, citizens who took these workshops, that the criminal is intending to be a criminal. Even if his planning is only 5 minutes, he's got 5 minutes on you. So part of what these crime prevention workshops would do would be rehearse scenarios so you can make up your mind ahead of time what you're going to do in a situation and not just be faced with something you never thought of and panic. Like if you're in your parking lot late at night and you're going for the keys in your car and somebody jumps you and says, get in the car, I'm just going to take your money. Well, a lot of police officers would say, do not go to a second crime scene. It's better to scream and fight right there in the parking lot than go off to a dark alley or a backwoods someplace where they're going to do something worse to you. Well, likewise, I would say rehearse scenarios. Think about things that can happen. I can meet so many assistant professors who say, I was shocked when this happened. And it's something that I've heard from 300 other assistant professors happening to them. So it wasn't a rare and unusual occurrence, but they haven't thought through how they would react if it happened. Like your first day of your new job in your office, and a senior professor walks in there and says, we're so glad to have you. I have a gigantic project I'd like to do with you. Come on, join me. What are you going to say at that point? No, or with a long Flintstone pause? Or are you going to have a coherent and cogent strategy for relating to time management and saying no and so on?
Mm-hmm. And so that kind of leads, and we do have a couple minutes left to that idea of picking your topics. One of the big concerns that I think most junior professors have, and certainly I've struggled with a bit, is figuring out what your research agenda is, what you're going to write about. And I'm curious, and I've been fortunate in the intellectual property law field. There are some terrific professors who have very generously given me their time, both personally and also have done conferences to give this kind of advice. And I'm thinking of people like Peter Yu, who's at Drake, not far from where you are, at Drake Law, or Eric Goldman at Santa Clara, and there are others who have, Mike Madison at Pitt, and others who have done these kinds of conferences for IP professors. And I'm curious to get your perspective on the research agenda, right? The finding that time to do what you need to do. It's certainly a benefit for me to do Hearsay Culture because I get to read material that I want to read, and I will read it more quickly because I'm interviewing someone. But I'm curious, for someone that doesn't have a radio show, what do you say about the research agenda, and in that very scenario where you have to potentially say no, knowing that you have something else you want to do?
Right. Well, you pointed out just in your own life several important lessons there. Many years ago, I read what was a transformative book for me, which I recommend to everybody, and I'm sorry, I'm getting old, I blanked on the author's name, but it's called Seasons of a Man's Life. It was a psychology professor, and he basically looked at, I think, 30 or 40 men, but I think the lesson applied equally to any gender, and asked them how they succeeded. And the core was a great mentor, was somebody who was willing to help them. The second thing you said was that you mentioned people outside of your university. Now, I'm sure you have a great mentor or great mentors in your university, but it's important for probationary faculty not just to think of the assigned mentor within the department, but finding some great man or woman in the field who's willing to take interest in you, who's willing to help you. The last part of it, though, is not every mentor can provide everything. I think one mistake, again, assistant professors make is they think a mentor should be a mentor for all seasons. It should cover everything. You can find somebody who's extraordinarily useful to you in your research, that's great. But they may not be so good in giving you advice on your personal, on your politics of your department, on your teaching, on your service, but you might find another great mentor for that. So don't expect too much from mentors, and don't expect your mentor to be right around the corner.
We're chatting with Professor David Perlmutter of the University of Iowa, author of the books Blog Wars, as well as Promotion and Tenure Confidential. Again, that's two books. David, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. This has been fascinating. I certainly invite you back to continue the discussion, but thank you for taking the time today to chat with my listeners.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm happy to mention a number of guests coming up for this fall quarter on KZSU. Next week, we'll be hearing from Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of the book Common as Air. Professor Leah Shaver, the following week, of Hostra Law. And then for the remainder of the quarter, Baron Zilka of Tech Freedom, co-author of The Next Digital Decade. Professor Ethan Lieb of UC Hastings College of Law, author of the book Friend versus Friend. Very timely topic given the discussion with David today. Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University discussing privacy and context. Dean Saul Levmore and Professor Martha Nussbaum of the University of Chicago Law School, co-editors of The Offensive Internet, Speech, Privacy, and Reputation. And then rounding out this quarter, Professor George Contreras of American University Washington College of Law. A number of guests have already been booked for the winter quarter, which will begin on KZSU in January of next year, and I always am looking for your suggestions for guests to have on the show. So any feedback suggestions or guest suggestions, you could send to me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to the show. You can listen this quarter, Thursdays at 3 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU FM Stanford, and that streams live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you will find not only Hearsay Culture, but all of the other events going on at the Center for Internet Society. And I should note, that my friend and a former colleague, Tony Falzone, argued the Golan case in the Supreme Court last week, and I suspect there will be events surrounding that issue of the restoration of works to copyright protection from the public domain. So that's a topic that I'm sure you'll be able to look for, among others, going on currently at CIS. You can also get the show by going to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, where you can click on the RSS feed, or you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can find all the previous 150 shows, as well as the schedule of upcoming guests. Thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.